Rumble Podcast, where I work at a magazine, and my best friend Judy Greer is full of sass. Oh, rom-coms.
It's Valentine's Day, time to
figure out
which movie is the most
charming, corny, and
we'll probably start with Ryan and Tom Hanks, cause it's always there. So kiss me.
Oh my God. Are you guys ready for a Valentine's Day bloodbath, baby, for some romance?
No, this isn't
on this day of St. Valentine, blood shall be spilt upon the land.
What's the primary color of Valentine's Day?
Red.
Blood red, blood. Baby.
This is right. Not about the Valentine's Day massacre.
You tell me Cupid.
Cupid's going for headshots.
Some people right in the jugular.
I feel like you guys have missed the point of Valentine's Day.
They bleed out and then they fall in love with the Lord, who they're going to meet really soon.
Fall in love with Jesus.
You're going to fall in love with Jesus this Valentine's Day. For some reason, Cupid's a Baptist priest. Welcome, guys, to the Brothers Murph Get Smart Valentine's Day rom-com battle, Royal Rumble. Whatever's the, a cool
it's
way our,
it's the
it.
Royal Rumble. We have a name.
It's the rom-com Royal Rumble.
You named it.
I did. But then I was like, do we, you know, it's all right. Anyway, so welcome, you guys. We have a fun four-way argument that's going to go on in honor of Valentine's Day. Something that Casey and I like to do every year around Valentine's Day is watch like old romantic films and things all about people getting schmooshy-poochy with each other.
Face off.
Yeah, exactly. That movie gets romantic at times. Anyway, so that's
not
what we're
predatory.
Talking about. We're talking specifically about rom-coms, romantic comedies today, and we've each chosen one of our favorite rom-coms, one that we think really encapsulates the genre as a whole. It is the most rom-commy rom-com of all, and we're going to battle, and we're going to let you folks out there decide which of these is the best, truly. Who argues it the best? We're like in court here. Y'all are the jury of our peers, and you're going to judge us harshly.
Drink. Yeah.
So again, we all have one different movie, and we're going to talk about them.
Mike, who is the we? Who's all battling?
I was going to get to that. So I am Michael Lee Murphy.
I'm Nick Murphy.
Casey Brown.
And I'm Michelle Fortier.
Michelle Fortier is our guest. So she's our, she knows all about everything rom-com, romance. She's all about it. She eats that schnit up. Okay. So she is here to really
come in
and dominate. So we'll see how she does here. I'm honestly a little bit nervous. You're the wild card, throwing in curveballs. So we'll see how this goes. So anyway.
I'm not nervous at all.
Ovalface over there is just quietly, he's just waiting. He's just in the ring saying, hey,
you
man,
you have a face shaped quite like this.
Oh my God.
You know, most people like heart-shaped faces, you know, especially around this time, Valentine's Day, but you know, it's still a top. Ovals.
Just give him like a little box of oval candies, which are also cheaper because they're defects from the candy shop.
Listen to our makeup episode if you want to know about Nick's stupid oval face.
Have a stupid oval face.
Or just reference any oval mirror.
I don't talk about it every podcast. Let's go. Okay.
Anyway, so we all have a different movie, guys.
Let's talk more about my face.
We will in the context of your film. Okay. So we all have a different movie. And real quick to start off, we're going to talk about what our movie is and a brief synopsis in case you guys haven't seen them. If you haven't seen any of these movies, shame on you because you should have. So I guess we'll just start with me. My film is Blast from the Past.
So good.
We're opening up with ours because mine is probably the least known.
You're like the underdog. Yeah.
A little bit. I'm the dark horse coming in. So Blast from the Past is a great film from 1999. It stars Brendan Fraser, Alicia Silverstone. I mean, come on.
So good.
Right? I'm talking, this is the same year that The Mummy came out. This is peak Brendan Fraser.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a couple of years
and you
removed.
And me have always been big Brendan Fraser fans. To this day, still love him.
Oh, he's my favorite. I love Brendan Fraser.
He gets so much shit and he doesn't deserve any of it.
I know.
He was perfect in The Mummy. He's still like my favorite crush is like Brendan Fraser from
Mummy's
The Mummy.
Absolutely. So that's why you guys should all love this, because Brendan Fraser is now thrust into the center of a romantical fun movie and they really harness his Brendan Fraser-ness perfectly.
True.
So this movie, it takes place in modern times, 1999, and we have Brendan Fraser, who's Adam. He has two wacky parents, Christopher Walken and Sissy Spacek are his parents. Christopher Walken is like a brilliant scientist inventor, but he's also super worried about nuclear war, which he assumes is about to happen.
Because at this point, it's back in the 60s.
Right. It opens up in the
1962.
Yeah. It's like literally the Cuban Missile Crisis is happening. And he has this whole shelter built, like a fallout shelter underneath their house. And a plane crash lands on top of their house, which he assumes was a nuclear bomb going off. He locks him and his family into this bunker, and they stay there for 35 years. And then they're let out right in the 90s. And all of a sudden, they're in a world that they think has been through nuclear annihilation, that's been rebuilt. Everything's horrible. But really what it is that time has passed, innocence has been lost, and they send Brendan Fraser out to get supplies to basically keep them in the shelter for longer. And he runs into Alicia Silverstone, who kind of teaches him up on modern times and kind of teaches him how to be a man.
Sex stuff.
Yeah. Super sex stuff. That in a nutshell is
a really filthy movie
from the past.
Yeah. Great movie. All right. I'm mostly going to be arguing for other people's movies, 'cause I just really like all
as you
movies.
Should.
My movie is my favorite, rom-com of all time. Always has been ever since I've been a kid. And our dad loves this movie, which is a common theme. Our dad is one of the people who really got us into movies. But my movie is 1998's The Wedding Singer. Oh, it's great. So good.
That's we're talking about an excellent movie.
You want to talk about iconic rom-com couples? It may not be as iconic as Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, as Casey will argue many times today, I'm sure. But Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler are just such a good couple on screen, because they're both weird and quirky, and The Wedding Singer is takes place back in the 80s, and I should get all the points for the sweet 80s mullets in this movie, because they're so strong in this movie. So Adam Sandler is a wedding singer. He sings at weddings. That's what he does. And Drew Barrymore is a waitress, I guess, for a catering company, it seems like. And they end up meeting, and Drew Barrymore, whose character's name is Julia, has this like really kind of douchey fiance. And in the beginning of the movie, Adam Sandler is also engaged, but then his fiance leaves him at the altar. She doesn't show up for the wedding.
Exactly.
So she doesn't show up. He's really sad. And then he kind of goes through this like downfall where he's just really sad all the time. And then like him and Drew Barrymore start hanging out and stuff like that. Even though she's got a fiance, they fall in love, and it's just so 80s and so good. And it's just, oh, it's just Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore, their peak rom-com times. And it's just the best. Oh,
yeah. I mean, it's like some of the best quotes from that movie. Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the more quotable movies on the planet. Yeah.
I still quote it like on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
As you should. So, Casey, what movie do you have?
I have the best rom-com of all time.
Okay.
I chose Sleepless in Seattle. I was going to choose a Meg Ryan movie, and it was which one at that point. And yeah, I decided to go Sleepless. It's so classic. So it came out in 1993. So mine is the oldest movie of ours, starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks in one of their many pairings together. And it is basically a love at first here. Not love at first sight, yeah. But Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks' wife has died, and so they're living in Chicago, he and his son, and they decide they need a change of scenery. So they move to Seattle, but his son thinks that he needs to get a new wife. He's been in mourning for too long, his dad. So he calls into this radio show, and Dr. Laura, Laura, right? I think that was her
Marcia,
name.
Marcia, I believe.
Marcia, you're right. Dr. Marcia Fieldstone.
10 points for Nick for knowing more about Casey.
I think
he
just stole some of
does.
Your points.
See this movie one time.
Dr. Marcia Fieldstone talks to him on the radio, Tom Hanks, about his wife, and Meg Ryan is listening on the other side of the country in Baltimore to this interview happen, and just starts, she just has to know more about this person on the other end of the radio. And so it's kind of a story of both of them moving, not together, they don't meet till the end of the movie, but when they do, it is one of the best moments in rom-com history, and that's it. So, right, it's great. Michelle, So you are doing?
The movie I chose is 27 Dresses, which right I feel on. Like is like the ultimate rom-com of the mid-2000s. And yeah. I don't think there's been a better rom-com since, or more rom-com-y of rom-coms.
That's fair.
Is my argument. It was with Katherine Heigl and James Marsden, and Ed Burns is in it, and Judy Greer. It's actually written and directed by women, so I was really excited about that. That's cool. Yeah, feminist plug.
Hell yeah.
The premise of this movie is this girl is always a bridesmaid, never a bride. She's been in 27 different weddings, so she's got 27 dresses.
What? That's what it's about.
Surprise.
I thought she was a seamstress.
So the whole premise is she's in love with her boss, and he is totally oblivious to her, and her sister comes to town and basically woos her boss away from her. And so the main character, Jane, is devastated that her sister is now like dating and then engaged to the boss. And meanwhile, there's this wedding columnist named Kevin, who is kind of like antagonizing her, but he's really intrigued by her, and they start hanging out and they're fighting a lot because she loves weddings and he's really cynical. And over time they sort of fall for each other, and she has this big confrontation with her sister, and then, you know, eventually she's the bride, so
everything works out.
Spoiler alert.
Then sex stuff.
Spoiler alert.
And then a bunch of sex stuff and cars and rain happens.
Yeah, and singing in bars.
That's true.
It's true. That is actually true.
So those are gonna be the four competitors, you guys. We have a good mix, I think.
Yeah.
And we had a rule ahead of time that we cannot repeat actors or actresses in main roles. So that's why we kind of have only one Meg Ryan versus having you can't have only Julia Roberts dominate. So we just kicked her out.
It could have been When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, and Joe vs. Volcano. And it could have been entirely Meg Ryan.
I feel like you should do a podcast of just Meg Ryan
Meg Ryan movie is the best.
You do the same thing with Drew Barrymore.
French Kiss would win.
Harry Met Sally would 100% win.
All right. That's the podcast. That's a different argument different for a different podcast. So guys, we want to talk a little bit about some of the things that make a rom-com a rom-com. So we created a rubric, mostly Casey over here, because she's gone deep. She's done a lot of research for her whole life. She's been preparing for this podcast.
Down that rabbit hole. Yeah.
But before we go too far, I do want to just say what definition we were all working off of as defining what a rom-com is, because that can be up for debate in itself. And so we all mutually agreed. I found this one online. So the definition online from the OED is a light and humorous movie whose central plot is a happy love story. So that's kind of the dictionary definition. And so we all agreed that it has to be something that is very funny. It can't be romance only. You know, that's why maybe a movie like The Princess Bride, we decided was more of a romance than a rom-com. Mm-hmm. But not so funny that it then becomes, you know, super bad. Or something.
Yeah, it's a comedy that has a love story.
So we decided for the sake of this podcast, we were going to choose adults. So they have to be adult people that are pairing up, because it's a whole other genre of teen romance movies that we could do and are going to do. Right. And so those are kind of what we were working off of, that it has to be funny, but it has to have a love story, and they have to be adults. And that's what we kind of base this rubric of ours around. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know, like, your guys' movies, how they did. Because Sleepless in Seattle, surprisingly, based on the rubric we mutually all agreed on, not super great.
Actually, same here.
Yeah. I don't know what the high score is. It's probably going to be Michelle.
My movie killed it with this rubric, you guys. I feel like you wrote this rubric for my movie.
Yours is very...
I had to keep pausing the movie to like read through and knock off things on this list because there were so many.
Yeah, I didn't do that well. I mean, it did okay.
With The Wedding Singer?
The Wedding Singer, yeah, sorry. The Wedding Singer did not do quite as well as I thought it would. There are certain things, and it's one of those things where like I feel like I could argue for a lot of points, because there's like one where if in the movie they say the title of the movie, that's a very rom-com, like I'm a wedding planner, you know, or something like that. So it's like, these things happen. They say, and we put on here, you get an extra point every time the title is said. They say The Wedding Singer so many times in that movie that I probably have about 100 score. Because he constantly refer to Robbie Hart, who is Adam Sandler. they constantly refer to him as the wedding singer.
My movie's the same way. They say Sleepless in Seattle every time he gets on the radio, and then they replay the whole radio thing. So they say it at least six times, I counted, of just Sleepless in Seattle. You're on with Sleepless in Seattle.
Whereas mine, I don't think they mention the title at all, because you'd be like, man, that's a blast from the past, ain't it? You know, it'd be a little
A little more well-written than that.
Yeah, thankfully.
Well, that's a blast from the past, there.
Yeah, so we have a lot of points on this rubric. There's 50 points in total, different individual items. My movie scored 20.
Okay.
I could probably argue for more, but Blast from the Past, a lot of our rubric centers around a big thing you see in rom-coms or weddings, different things like that, nuptials, fiancés, and everything. And my film doesn't have any of that going on. So I wasn't able to kind of capitalize, but we've got fun stuff. Like, I've got a doubler here, because one of the items is if the main character has a sassy best friend. And there's a bonus on that point is if that sassy best friend is gay, because Brendan Fraser refers to Alicia Silverstone as his best friend, because this is the first person he really meets in the world.
Yeah.
So he refers to her as his best friend, and she's sassy. And then she has a best friend in Dave Foley, who's gay. So bam, bam, I've got like a chain link thing going on here. So I got a doubler off that.
Wait, can I talk about that one too? Because I would like to say, isn't Rosie O'Donnell all of our original sassy gay best friends?
Yeah, seriously. Probably.
Yeah, right?
She's sassy and gay.
Like,
and
maybe not in the context of this film, but in real life, we all know in our heart of hearts, she was our original sassy gay best friend.
I thought I had seen, I had not seen 27 Dresses, I will say that. I thought I had seen Sleepless in Seattle before. I haven't, because I definitely didn't know that Bill Pullman and Rosie O'Donnell were in that movie, and I love Bill Pullman.
Great
and
cast.
I love Rosie O'Donnell, and the fact that she pisses off Trump all the time now just makes me that much.
She's
love
like
her
my
that much
hero.
More.
Yeah,
but I love her because I love, and she doesn't get nearly as much work. I just love her, and I think because I remember as a kid, I thought that Sleepless in Seattle and Philadelphia were the same movie. Because they're both Tom Hanks. They're the same era, and they both have a name of a city. Casey, they're not.
I don't know if you know that,
but they're not the same movie.
If anyone doesn't know, Philadelphia is a drama that came out around that time.
Like a pretty intense drama.
With
really
AIDS
heavy film.
And HIV.
But I never saw it as a kid or when I was a teenager, because I was like, Sleepless in Seattle, the movie's so sad. It's like Requiem for a Dream. Like, all I ever hear is about how sad this movie is. I'm like, why would I watch this movie?
I will argue that Sleepless in Seattle is super sad, so you're not wrong, but we'll get to that in a minute. So does anyone else have any fun parts from their rubric that they thought was interesting?
I want to say something about diversity, because my movie does not have a lot of diversity in terms of race. It's mostly just a ton of white people.
I think white people in the 80s,
blanket
right?
For all of
I
our
feel like
films.
That's yeah, accurate to all of our
except
films.
For I do want to make a point of saying that I have a trans person in my movie, in George. And George is played by a real trans person in real life who unfortunately recently passed away.
Oh, yeah, Alexis
in Alexis Arquette. And in the movie, George is definitely trans or gay or something. It's never really explained because he's kind of a minor character.
It's a
but
boy
I want to
George
get extra points
person.
For having a trans person in, and everyone just accepts him and loves him and stuff. I mean, and
yeah.
To be fair, George is kind of the butt of people's jokes, but George is part of the band and is very much accepted and part of like all the wedding planning going on and everything. So.
And I never really noticed that until I was rewatching it. I was like, oh yeah, like that's like a pretty, and it, again, it's played by Alexis Arquette, you know, who is, again, who recently passed away, unfortunately, but was trans as well. And I was like, that's so cool. Like,
yeah.
I never really noticed that.
From that movie to Laverne Cox, there's not much going on, but hey, good on them for doing that.
What about your, I mean, you said you kind of knocked it out of the park. So did you just hit every single point pretty
much? I just feel like this movie just hit like every cliche of like, she had a sassy gay, sassy friend, and that friend was Judy Greer, who is like the actress who's the friend in every movie.
Yeah.
And I
it
mean,
is
like,
on the rubric.
For years, I knew her as just like, oh, that friend in those movies. And so she was in this. I mean, like there's like the wedding thing. There's a montage of them trying on all of her bridesmaid dresses. They get drunk at a bar. She tells them all of her inner feelings. Like she works for this magazine as an assistant, but has this really dope apartment, and you're just like, girl, like I don't understand how you could afford that. Like I'm an assistant in LA and I live in a like shack. Like I'm like, I don't know what you can afford. This gorgeous
even
New York apartment.
Like, oh, like you gotta get rid of these 27 dresses because you don't have much space in New York.
Her closet
and
I'm like,
she has
huge.
Tons of space
That's
in New York.
That's the biggest closet. I could fit a bed in that closet. Yeah,
on the job front, I got 2 points for that because we put a list of careers and she works as a journalist and he's an architect. Those are such rom-com jobs.
That's very true. Yeah. That's very true.
Yeah, no. So this movie was just like super like rife with like all of these kind of tropes that you expect from a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And I just really like is. Found it so entertaining, like how many things I kind of knocked off my list. I think I got about 24 to 25. There was a couple that were like iffy, but I was like, I could argue this.
Yeah. Without the bonus points for the saying the name of the movie, I got 21.
Nice.
So. I only got 16 without any of the extra bonuses. That I probably scored the lowest, actually, weirdly enough. But if you go through again, it's just like, despite the fact that the entire thing bases around weddings and stuff, it doesn't really hit a lot of the rubrics. And again, like, we're not going to go through the whole rubric here, so we'll be posting the rubric, so make sure to look at it and, you know, compare it to your favorite rom-com, or at least, you know, because they weren't, compared to our Christmas Royal Rumbles, where they were pretty high, a lot of the scores, this one, all these are not doing quite as good.
Well, I guess rom-coms maybe have more variety than a typical Christmas movie.
Well, and especially because, like, the theme essentially is love. Whereas a Christmas movie, it has to be based around Christmas somehow. So you're going to hit a lot of the same things. Love is like a really broad topic. You know, it's like it could really be anything.
And the movies we picked are really different movies. I mean, we kind of picked a wide spectrum of movies that I like feel like kind of bring a lot of different things to the table.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And on that note, let's get into these movies a little bit, because I know that something that happens with me is there are certain movies that I grew up with and they're part of my life. But I can now kind of acknowledge rewatching them that, like, this isn't great, but it's one of my movies.
Yeah, okay? Totally.
One example is, I think everyone who didn't grow up with the Goonies watches it as an adult and they're like, this is a pile of hot garbage. And I'm like, how dare you?
The Goonies is the greatest movie.
I know, because everyone in this room is amazing. But there are some people, if you didn't grow up with it, you're like, I don't. Why?
I named my car Chester Copperpot after the Goonies because I love that movie so much.
Again. We have like literally a Goonies board game and all this, but
yeah. On that note, though, and Michelle, you can probably relate. There are a lot of like animated movies that I grew up watching that now I'll like go rewatch The Swan Princess.
Oh, it's rough.
That's bad.
I rewatched that recently, and I was like, bad. This is really rough. But I love that movie.
I love present day, but it's bad. It's real bad.
It's nostalgia.
So yeah. I wonder, are our movies actually good, or are they just movies that we love, and did they perform well in their time? Have they had a following since?
Because at this point, your movie do are relatively old. Like, what, when was your movie, Michelle?
My movie came out in 2008,
the most recent.
Okay, so mine's recent, the newest then, one, but that's still almost a decade.
Yeah, and all of ours are from the 90s. Mm-hmm. So mine's at least I think still holds up very well with today's audience and stuff. Again, it's charming Adam Sandler, not like I got that Adam Sandler from like Billy Madison. It's like fun, charming Adam Sandler who's really charming and likable and great.
He's a great romantic interest in this movie.
Yeah,
is so weird because I never would think that about Adam Sandler, but I loved him. Like,
who would have thought?
He was wonderful.
I love all of our movie choices.
I mean, these are great movies. Yeah,
and then it performed very well. It was made on a budget of $18 million, and it made $80 million in the box office. And especially in the 90s, that's pretty darn good. I mean, that'd be good for a romantic comedy today.
It's pretty good ROI.
Yeah, it's pretty darn good.
My movie did not do great.
Yours is an underappreciated. We hope more people leave watching Blast from the Past.
If you don't do anything else after this podcast, watch Blast from the
Past. Give it a try, because I really think that it's more original than people gave it credit for and really has something going for it. But my film was made on a $35 million budget.
Really?
Probably more expensive than it should have been.
Wow.
And it made $26 million back.
Oof. Oh, painful.
And was not super loved by critics. I think it has a Metacritic score of 48. So it's not the worst movie of all time, but it ain't an A+.
So weird.
And I think there were some things going against it. I think like Alicia Silverstone had a tough time after Clueless. She like hit the scene so hard that I think it was really tough. And so this is like 4 years later. And I think people were like, well, you're just like the whatever, you know, as if. And she's like, no, you know, I'm more grown up now. And I think she really does a good job of kind of stepping out of the shadow of Clueless.
That's a hard shadow to step out of.
Oh, my God.
Playing Cher Horowitz, you're not going to escape that.
Right.
Yeah. And it's an iconic role. So.
Yeah. And I think people maybe weren't ready to go on the journey with Brendan Fraser and Alicia Silverstone, which is admittedly kind of an odd pairing. You wouldn't think of, but it totally works.
It's a really quirky film. Like, it sort of has a really niche style. It's really quirky. It's very, like, Valley-centric, like the L.A. Mm-hmm, Valley. Mm-hmm. But I think it's so delightful. Like, it's such a fun movie.
Yeah. That's why everyone needs to see it. That's why I'm arguing for it, you guys. Come on.
How did 27 Dresses do?
So, 27 Dresses, it cost $30 million to make. And they, domestic gross was $76
million. Solid.
So, it, like, did pretty well for itself. I mean, I remember when it came out, it was really popular. I saw it in the movies with friends. So it, like, did pretty well for itself. And I think it's, like, a really, I feel like it's one of, like, the top romantic comedies of that time of, like, sort of being, it hits all these notes. It's funny. It's romantic. It's engaging. Like, you like the story of it. I mean, like, James Marsden is so cute. And, like, you know,
so good.
You feel like you're, like, these young girls watching this movie and you totally fall in love with it. He's charming. The idea of it is great. And it's got really good humor. Like, Judy Greer has, like, all these great one-liners. Kristen Ritter pops up for, like, briefly as, like, this kind of, I don't know, bitchy
receptionist?
Assistant? Receptionist, yeah. And she's, like, just, like, really funny. So, I love the movie. I think it's really fun for a rom-com.
That's a Blast from the Past budget. I can see because they had, you know, the bunker and everything. $30 million for 27 Dresses seems like a lot of money for, like, a romantic comedy.
Blast from the Past makes way less sense because it was made, like, 10 years earlier.
Yeah, but there's just a lot more settings and... I don't know. It just seems like, why do they... I guess, I don't know. Big name
actors.
That's
a question you can make for a lot of movies. It's like, why did this cost this? You know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, your guys' movies are cute, but you're talking to the one of the highest grossing rom-coms of all time. Sleepless in Seattle, when it debuted domestically on a $21 million budget, made $126 million, or has since it came out. Wow. And overall, worldwide, has made almost $230 million.
Wow, that's impressive.
And rom-coms aren't typically movies that transfer to a worldwide audience because they're very, you know, language focused. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Sleepless in Seattle did. So
right on.
Pull a Tom Hanks.
And I will also say another metric that we can measure by is I personally think that movies have gotten longer and longer and longer and
movies
longer.
Movies are too long.
There's no reason that movies need to regularly be 3 hours. And whose movie is the shortest of everyone's? Sleepless in Seattle, surprisingly. Shortest runtime of all of ours. So they get their message across and they're out.
Lickety split.
I like that you're such a Ravenclaw that you, like, research this.
Yeah,
I've got 4 pages of notes.
She's
I admire Casey for that so much because she is so diligent in her note taking and her knowledge. Page. Like, Casey knows her shit.
Ahead of time, she's like, do you know who directed your movie? Because I do. And I'm like, okay.
Do you know who directed mine? Nora Ephron. I win.
But she's a queen.
Yeah.
Nora Ephron is a goddess.
She's the best. Slay,
RIP girl. We love you.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we need to get into some crosstalk here because we all, I think.
Well, we can all agree my movie made the most money on the best budget. And
numbers are cool. Sure. But we're talking about matters of the heart here with a rom-com.
This is love.
This is love, you guys.
It's a big deal.
And as much as I love all these films, they're problematic. So I think we need to get into talking about why is your film really so superior and what are the faults in each other's films? Okay, I'll start off right now. I'm going to get the ball rolling. I'm going to throw a whammy out here. Sleepless in Seattle is not a rom-com.
I second that.
It is a romance film.
Mm-mm.
There is not enough humor in it to get the calm part. And I'll 27 Dresses borderline. But Sleepless in Seattle, it has this kind of, you have Tom Hanks in the beginning, you're opening up, he's like literally at the funeral, right, for his wife?
Yeah.
I mean, damn.
Kind of
you don't think that the greatest comedy has come out of tragedy? What about Tig Notaro? What is her life?
Listen.
Just breast cancer, and she's a great comedian.
But the problem is that melancholy kind of carries throughout the entire film, all the way up to the end. It's not this big jubilation. It's kind of like they meet and they kind of just walk off into their sunset. Exactly. It's magical. It's romantic.
Here's my biggest issue with Sleepless in Seattle, which I love. Like, I love Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks. They are the perfect pairing. My issue is they don't meet until the end. Like, how is it a rom-com when two people are on the opposite ends of the country, not interacting really, besides her listening to them on the radio, and the ending is when they meet? Like, that should be, like, for me, the start of the rom-com. It's like, oh, we've met, now, like, shenanigans ensue.
That's more of a romantic idea, I think. You know, Meg Ryan has this image of what Tom Hanks is, and is kind of seeking him out and being quite reckless throughout the whole film off these romantic ideals. So I really think that while it's great, like, there's not really any hijinks There's no shenanigans.
Oh, okay. Just because there's no hijinks doesn't mean it's not a funny movie. Firstly, this movie was written by Nora Ephron, punched up by her sister, Delia, who is incredibly funny. Nora Ephron, who's also done When Harry Met Sally, Julie and Julia. I mean, just an incredible track record. But there's so many funny moments. Every time that Tom Hanks talks to his son, it's very funny. His son is asking him about sex scenes and movies, and, oh, is that when you have all the scratches down your back? And he's like, how do you know that? You're 10. And Rob Reiner and him, every time they're talking, you know, saying about women are all about men's butts now, and Tom Hanks asks Rob Reiner, well, how's my butt? And they walk on. It's dialogue. It's witty banter, and I'm sorry that you guys didn't understand it.
See, I don't know. See, I feel like it falls more along the lines of, like, Princess Bride is, like, a really funny movie. Like, there's a ton of comedy in that, but, like, I don't think anyone would consider that a
Princess
rom-com.
Bride is literally funnier than Sleepless in Seattle, and Princess Bride is not a rom-com.
I can't, oh my gosh. Did you guys listen to the dialogue?
Yes, I laughed plenty.
The scene when she's describing An Affair to Remember, Rita Wilson, and she's just crying, and then Tom Hanks and Vincent Garber start describing the Dirty Dozen in the same way. That's a hilarious scene.
But I don't think that it has the camp that you get from romantic comedies. Like, you look at, you know, The Wedding Singer or 27 Dresses. Like, that has camp. And I think that...
That's not part of our definition. So you should have included that at the outset.
But the point is even the moments where Tom Hanks is asking Rob Reiner, like, how do I bone down now? It's still melancholy. He's still kind of like, my wife's dead, so I guess I should learn how to talk to
ladies.
Here's
the reason why it's not a rom-com. This movie is a psychological thriller, because ultimately it's about a stalker. Can we just admit that? Like, this is some creepy stalker shit.
Yeah.
I love the movie, and it ends up being romantic because they have the really kind of awkward but beautiful last scene, you know, where they hold hands. They're kind of just weirdly staring at each other, but you feel the power. Mm-hmm. And it ends great. But ultimately, she's just straight up stalking this person to the point where she goes across the country to, like, talk to some man she doesn't know.
Because that's what you do for romance.
Oh, exactly.
A grand romantic gesture, which is on our list of things.
You meet him, you make a lamp out of his skin, and it's just romantic. You want to keep that skin
nearby. The thing is, Nick, that this movie is so smart that it is self-referential, and it is kind of a meta criticism of other romantic movies. Literally, a line in the movie is, you don't want to be in love, you want to be in love in a movie. And so they talk about Fatal Attraction in this movie. They're referencing that some of these things that happen in movies are crazy. And Meg Ryan has a whole conversation with her shrink brother about, what am I thinking? This is crazy. What? But she does it anyway because some part of her knows that it's important to follow your instincts. And to follow your instincts for love, a lot of times it pays off in dividends.
Yeah. Exactly. But again, I think it doesn't take away from the fact or change that it's romantic. Everything in this movie is capital R romantic. Not romantic comedic.
Right. Answer me this. Do you respect the American Film Institute?
Never heard of it. Moving AFI? On.
AFI? Okay. AFI, who makes great lists all the time of the best movies, the best actors, best actresses. I'm sorry, whose movie is on their top 10 rom-coms? Would it be Nick's, Michelle's, Mike's? No. For sure. No, that's Sleepless in Seattle. Number 10 on their list of 100.
I mean,
it's like the obligatory, you have to say, like, The Godfather and Citizen Kane. It's like
it's
that.
It's the Citizen Kane romantic film.
No, because there's a lot of baloney lists about rom-coms that I was looking through, and I'm like, that's a romantic movie. That's not a rom-com. That's like a freaking sad-ass movie. This movie, yes, it has complex people, but one of the things about a rom-com is two complex people who fall in love, and my characters are more complex than anybody's in any of these films.
Here's something
that tell me Robbie Hart is not complex. You know how hard it is to get that mullet that shiny and perfect?
I am telling you that to your face.
That is so much body in that hair.
Here's one more thing about this, why I think it's more of a romantic movie and it is commenting on other films. I think something that's important in a rom-com is clarity. Clarity of your heroes and villains, like a Western, okay? In a good rom-com, you know who the douchebag boyfriend is right away. In this film, you have Bill Pullman.
Who's the nicest man ever.
Like, yes. Best, nicest dude of all time.
Yep.
Just gets cast aside. And it's so ridiculous that even his character is just like, yeah. Well, I really want someone who likes me, so I guess I'll take my wheezing allergies elsewhere.
In all honesty, he takes that way too well.
Well, okay, like, and Nora Ephron did that on purpose because she didn't want as a female director and a female writer, she didn't want to come off as this is some terrible dude. And it's she knew that trope that, oh, it's obvious mm-hmm. that this person should be with this person, which I think is a deficit to a lot of rom-coms. It's a bad thing that you just sit there, like, literally watching The Wedding Singer. I was like, why has Julia been with Glenn this long?
Yeah, it's a fair question.
Why?
He is like the worst.
He's so terrible. And you just sit there, and so it becomes unrealistic, which is a movie, and that's fine. This movie, though, I think has these grand gestures based in so much realism in terms of how people are dealing with their emotions. And Bill Pullman reacts, and I've never had somebody, if I've broken up with someone in real life, who's like thrown something or like, you know, screamed. My breakups in the past have been very civil. And Bill Pullman, yeah, it's a great breakup. It's how you'd want it to go. But in a movie, don't you want it to be how a breakup should go? You want it to be the idealized version of a breakup so you can go find your true love?
But that doesn't bring good comedy. Idea.
Yeah.
That isn't good comedy if it's like, oh, you know, he great. Reacted
a good
nicely.
Pie in the face. That's what should have happened.
I'm sorry
scene.
That we're not talking about Adam Sandler, lowest common denominator. Let's make some fart jokes.
That's
and
not The Wedding Singer. You can argue that for
Singer
a lot of Adam Sandler movies.
It is not The Wedding Singer.
But that's not The Wedding Singer.
No, it's not. It's, again, and I love The Wedding Singer.
This is not the
I just can't believe that you are trying to argue that Nora Ephron, who is the only one of these screenwriters who has ever been nominated for an Oscar for her work, is not a comedy writer. She's written books and essays, tons of them on comedy,
but
in
here's
comedy.
The thing. She's a comedy writer. This film was not one of those comedies. It's not a comedy.
No,
that
it's a real. It's a
anything.
Comedy with real people and real dialogue that is funny and humorous and highbrow. It is.
Oh, we're highbrow.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I don't think rom-coms want to be
Michelle,
highbrow.
We're not fancy.
I didn't get
it's
that
a
memo.
Highbrow movie, and if we were going for the lowest common denominator, we should have all decided on that, and I would have picked a different film, but I picked the best rom-com.
No, I know why. I know why. I didn't have my monocle on. That's why I wasn't fancy enough.
You
I was not
right.
Like, hello, funny.
Okay.
Are you all done?
I had to get hers out of the way first because I knew that it was going to get fierce.
She's going to argue real hard.
I don't know why I even stay. You guys are just going to gang up on Sleepless in Seattle like it's not even a real rom-com, then I'm not going to participate.
We'll let the people decide. Luckily, we're just giving our arguments. You gave yours, and the people will decide. Nick, I want to talk about your film.
That's fair.
I grew up, obviously, I'm this man's brother.
True.
Okay, so.
But you guys are related.
The wedding scene, I know.
Oh, my God.
We don't look it.
For the purposes of the show, we are. Yeah. It's better for branding.
We met at a Whole Foods one.
Who hasn't?
You want to play my brother in a podcast?
It's like my Tinder profile. Just tell your parents we met at Whole Foods.
Yeah. It's always a good start. So, The Wedding Singer I grew up with, I've been with this movie as long as you have. And for a long time, I never looked on it with any sort of critical lens. And I had to force myself to do that this week. And unfortunately, some things just, it just doesn't work out. Okay, Nick, I will make the argument that, Robbie and Julia should never get together. They should never be together. It is bad for business, folks.
And
think about this. They have no plan. They have no plan. Guarantee after the end, when they get married, they go back to living in Robbie's sister's basement because he's a wedding singer.
That's all they ever want, though.
She's a waitress. Like, you got a lot of people in that house.
But that's the thing is, like,
those people are sad.
It's not like they need anything more than that. That's the whole thing is, like, they need each other and they need each other's love. Like, there's never been, like, again, that's the whole thing is, like, Holly, who is Drew Barrymore's sister in the movie. Holly, you know, convinces Robbie, Adam Sandler, that Julia, one of the reasons why Julia is marrying Glenn, because Adam Sandler's like, why are you marrying this dude? Is because, you know, for the security, for the money. And then Julia gets extremely angry about that. She's not in it for the money. She's in it for the love. So clearly, like, okay, yeah, I'm sure they're not going to want to live in their sister's basement forever, but, like, that's not on their minds right
now.
They
super
don't care.
Are, though.
Love.
They have no skills whatsoever.
They're not moving out anytime soon.
I agree about looking at Wedding Singer, because I love the way, it's my favorite Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah.
Oh, hands down.
But I've never looked at it in a critical way, and I have a couple issues. I agree with Mike. Firstly, probably I don't fair. Think that Drew Barrymore gets as much of a chance to be as funny as she could be.
I agree.
In that movie.
I agree.
Flat out. She's hilariously funny, and she gets, like, one drunk scene, And that's it. Also, there's this weird preoccupation about like the dangers of drinking. And I don't think that it's a bad thing, but I never noticed that like Steve Buscemi's character out the gate, too drunk. Kid, like, oh man, you're too drunk. You better get better. Glenn. Julia gets too drunk. Glenn drinks. Robbie at the plane is like, oh, I don't want to drink. I got to go meet Julia. And I'm like, there's so much stuff. Like, there who wrote is, this movie?
And especially because Robbie and Julia both, a couple times they say like, oh, I'm not a big drinker.
She's like, oh, I just drinking Coke. It's like this big point of, I'm like, I never even noticed. I'm it not is, saying I mean, it's a bad thing.
It
it's,
is interesting though.
I would argue that they make it such a big thing because these characters actually have nothing in common. There's nothing that brings them together, so they have to create anything they can. There's I don't like to drink. You don't? All right, let's get married forever now.
Yeah, that's the plot of the movie, guys.
Julia's
that's
pretty,
it.
Pretty. She's the Drew Barrymore can carry a romantic lead because her smile is like
she's
sunshine
just so charming,
in a person. But right. her character's pretty one-dimensional. Like, she just decides she's going to marry Glenn because they've been together so long. That's not a very modern-day woman thing to do.
No, she isn't, and I do agree.
I guess it's the 80s, so.
It is the 80s, and I do agree.
Plus, she
got
that pressure from her mom about getting married. Yeah, that's
like
a big part
pregnancy,
of it.
Yeah. I do wish she had more to do. And I wish she was more how she is in 50 First Dates, where she's kind of more quirky and stuff. Cause that's Drew Barrymore is really quirky. Like, obviously, like, as we all know, if you know anything about her life or anything like that. And that's one thing, like, I feel like a lot of rom-coms focus. It's mostly, I would say the main character is usually a woman. And this one, I would say it's probably Adam Sandler. If you had to pick, like, if there was one main character, it'd probably be him over her. And weirdly enough, Blast in the Past, I think, is as well. I would say probably it's Brendan Fraser's, like, the main character. And then Alicia Silverstone's, like, the very close second main.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably why. And it's one of the things, like, a lot of the quirky, like, female character is, like, her sister Holly. And I do kind of wish they put more of the quirks on Drew Barrymore. And
sure.
I will agree with that.
And,
like,
my biggest criticism of the movie, though, is that this is a movie that we have seen a million times before and better. Done better. The plot of the movie is this guy and the girl should be together. Everybody realizes they should be together. And then they're not together until the last 2 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, and it's the best one.
No, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers did it in the 30s, and they could dance backwards
movies.
In heels.
No, seen those movies.
I'm sorry again.
And I'm sorry,
that
they're
you
not
haven't
singing
seen them.
Sweet 80s tunes. Because one thing our Ruby
I feel like you
soundtrack.
Can't compare Adam Sandler and like Fred Astaire.
Oh,
like,
no,
sure
but
can.
You
different
can.
Genres,
okay.
different
have
cultures.
You heard
the
Wedding the
Planner.
It's beautiful.
The Wedding Planner, Sweet Home Alabama. America's Sweetheart. They're all movies
Sweet
that
Home
you
Alabama
watch.
Is not better than The Wedding Singer.
They're movies that you watch that literally are the same plot. Like, these two should obviously be
it's
together.
It's a very rom-com-y plot, for
it's
sure.
It's tried and
sort
true.
Of a rom-com trope.
Yeah, it's a trope of the rom-coms. I don't think that's necessarily
it's a trope.
Anything against
I just think
it.
we should prize movies that are original, like Blast from the Past and Sleepless in Seattle, that
Boom.
Go outside of the tropes.
Boom.
But also, I would disagree with that because I think that rom-coms as a thing are tropes. Like, that's what a rom-com is. Like, you go to a rom-com because you know what you're getting. Like, as like a girl, you're like, oh, I want to go to the movies and I want to see this movie about this person who falls in love and all these things happen. And you don't go in for like originality. You go
but
in for when, like comfort.
When
and
so you I think go that, in for originality, isn't it a nice, delightful thing that you find?
If you keep the tropes and then flip some of them on their head. So it's the familiar
and, like,
and
oh.
the new.
That's how nice.
That's fair. That's fair.
Okay, Nick, one thing I also want to add. Julia definitely gets off on Robbie's sadness. Like, he sings a song full of rage and tears, and at the
it's
end,
so
she's creepily smiling.
Yeah,
like,
that is true. I'm not even arguing against that. She's just like, I liked it. I'm like,
yeah,
why?
Because you're a creep.
I think she's just being nice.
She's oh, no.
So good.
No.
She's into it. I think she's being supportive. I think she's like, this guy's a hot mess. I mean, like, maybe in her head, she's like a little like unhinged.
Yeah.
But she's being like a supportive friend. Like, you've never been there for your friend where they're like a disgusting mess and you know in your head that like they're being like terrible, but you're like, it's okay. You're great.
And
that's a good friend.
It's one of those things where it's like, they might be dancing like Fred. I'm trying to make a weird
Fred Astaire.
I know his last name. I was trying to think of a funny way to call him, but I couldn't think of anything. But it's like, I do like the fact that like,
Nora
it's
Efron
Adam,
could
it's
have.
Adam's, yeah, Zac Efron, we get it. And so.
You are going to have hordes of angry feminists writing.
I like Nora Efron a lot. I just like making Casey angry. It's fun. But I do like the fact that, like, again, it's all really ridiculous 80s movies. We talk about soundtracks. Like, this is, like, we talk about in the rubric, it says, like, a soundtrack of the time. Like, And again, the time in the movie is the 80s, and it's just like the most 80s soundtrack ever.
Anytime Spin Me Right Round comes on, I just like have to dance.
And you really get to see like how talented Adam Sandler is, because he's a good singer, he's a good musician, and he's like actually singing the entire time. It's not someone else, you know. In the last song, again, one of the things on our rubric is like some big moment that would never actually happen in real life. And I want to talk about everyone's, because I'm pretty sure there's a big moment in everyone's movie that would never actually happen in real life. But the last scene where he's on the plane and he writes a song for Julie and he's singing on the plane with Billy Idol for some reason, you know, just because it's the 80s, you know. And it's just like, I love that. I love, and that's one thing. It's like, yeah, it's very typical rom-com, but I think it takes it up and it kind of maybe takes it back to the old times where there was more of a performance and stuff, because you get to see him sing and stuff like that. You really get to see like the talent of Adam Sandler that I want back so bad. Yeah. And he just makes me so sad with everything he does in the last decade. Cause I'm just like, you're so good. Like you're so, oh, you're such
this,
a good,
I just this whole episode is just a plea to Adam Sandler to come back to us.
Please, like, do stuff like this, like where you're singing and you use your talent. You're not just like, that's my boy or whatever the crap he does nowadays. And I just can't handle it. Oh, sorry. It's so sweet and he's so good. And it's just, I love the fact that he's always singing and you really get to see the talent of like, yeah. I mean, and that last song is just so damn beautiful.
It is. That's a beautiful song. Okay, so we've bagged on Nick's movie. I wanted to, my issue with 27 Dresses.
Okay,
there should be 28.
Here goes.
No, okay. Firstly, George is so boring. He's really boring. Like, I'm so good and I do everything good. And
yeah, why does she like him that
But
much?
It is like Ed Burns and he is like so charming. So I get it. Like, it's Ed Burns.
He can play it, I guess. But the thing that to me is the most unbelievable about that movie, and there's a lot, is that any idea that Katherine Heigl would be the dowdy sister. Like, we're talking about one of the most beautiful women of the time, Katherine Heigl, in 2008. Like, gorgeous, tall, Hollywood starlet, like, on a huge sitcom, or not sitcom, a huge series of Grey's Anatomy. Mm-hmm. And the fact that somebody's like, oh, yeah, this dowdy one over here, and then Malin Ackerman comes in. I'm like, yeah, she gets to wear the shiny dress, and Katherine Heigl wears the brown dress. And they're trying to hide that she's got a slamming bod under there.
I mean, but that's sort of the thing with every rom-com, is that you've got these hot leading actresses that they dress down, like, hardcore. And you're like, okay, like, come on. Like, these people are all gorgeous and flawless.
That is true. It's just, it's like so unbelievable. Okay, Mount Ackerman's gorgeous, but so is Katherine Heigl. That's so crazy to me. Yeah.
Also, on the note of like attractive people in rom-coms, everyone is attractive. This is true. But I will say for our movies, Nick, you have Adam Sandler as your leading man.
Who's by far the least attractive.
I have Brendan Fraser, who is like not your first choice. You have Tom Hanks, who has great everyman appeal.
Yes.
Yeah.
James Marsden is like a model.
James Marsden is a wedding newspaper writer. He writes about weddings. I'm sorry, but there is no world where a dude who looks like James Marsden writes about weddings for a newspaper. That dude has sex professionally.
I mean, like, I can't argue that. Like, he is way too hot for this movie.
He's just like a cynical guy who like can't get by in the newspaper world. I'm sorry. He's the editor in chief. No problem.
He like works in weddings. He doesn't like it. And his boss is Jan from The Office.
Which is awesome.
Which I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But like, I feel like, you know, like, I think that, like, yeah, it is a little unrealistic, but that's, like, that's romantic comedies. Like,
no,
it's
it
never,
goes beyond.
I mean, but Matthew McConaughey in 10 Things I Hate, I mean, Hello's Guy in 10 Days was, like...
But he's, like, Mr. Suave reporter guy. James Marsden is, like, I'm gonna wear my sneakers to this interview.
I'm a wedding anarchist and stuff, and it's just, like, yeah, I'm like, dude, even Jan from The Office, like, mentions it. She's, at one point, she's, like, creepy over, and she's, like... She's like, in your way too attractive face or something like that. I'm like, yeah, even she's acknowledging, like, why are you in this movie?
I want to see a deleted scene where he definitely, like, breaks up a couple weddings because the bride just, like, goes and bangs him in a closet. Like, he's like, whoops. Good story, though.
Basically, the dowdiness is the unrealistic James Marsden hotness, but, like, you don't have as much of a douche boyfriend as you have literally, like, the worst sister ever that has ever existed.
But I don't and even by the end of it, she doesn't even really ever get redeemed that much.
Oh, no. But I don't feel like that's a flaw of the movie. I feel like that's just like a terrible sister. And I feel like...
She's the worst.
Best reference. But no, but she is terrible. I mean, like, arguably. And that's the thing for me that was shocking is just how awful she is and how she just doesn't get it ever.
Well, it's like when Katherine Heigl, like, busts her out at, like, the... What? rehearsal dinner or something, like that.
It's like the, or the,
yeah. And like, she shows that she's essentially been lying to George this entire time. I was like, end of the movie. Perfect. James Marsden, her, you guys go hook up somewhere. Perfect. Done. Cause I was just like, this sister 1,000% deserves all of this. And yeah. I really hope they never get back together.
That was
and
like cold though.
And the very end, she like finally like comes forth to George and she's just like, here's all these things that I lied to you about. And he should be like, yeah, cool. We shouldn't be together because you and me are nothing alike. And like, he should have just walked away and I would have been happy. Cause she does not deserve George.
I mean, they did break up. I mean,
they get back together.
But I feel like it's vague enough that I don't know. I don't think he would necessarily get back to her. I feel like it was just kind of like a bridging, healing wound.
It is very much implied that they're going to end up together. You can't be like, maybe they don't. Like, maybe she ends up with a little brother.
I just think for me, like, this movie is such a, like, it hits all these great notes. It's funny. It's romantic. I mean, James Marsden is so charming.
He really redeems a lot of what you could negatively say about it. He's very charming.
He is so charming. Like, you can't not fall in love with this guy. He's got like a slight weird accent. Did you notice watching this movie? He's got like a little bit of his like New York accent, but it isn't always there. But I think that he's really charming. I think they have great chemistry. And I think that they've got all these kind of great notes of romantic comedies and of this humor, the Judy Greer moments. And I just think it really like pops as a mid-2000s romantic comedy. There aren't other ones that came out around that time or since then that like have the sort of longevity of 27 Dresses.
I will say this though. That movie could be funnier. It's not, there's not really that much humor. There's this air of like meanness throughout the film. Like Malin Ackerman, obviously we just talked about, is horrible. But even when Katherine Heigl kind of busts her out and reveals all the truth about her, it's kind of just sad and mean. I wish that scene was more grand, or there was some bigger gesture and like more zany. And it's just kind of, it's just like,
It is
like you said, it's cold
and I agree that the movie could be funnier, especially considering that the woman who wrote it wrote The Devil Wears Prada, which is hilariously funny.
Oh yeah. No,
and so movie. You're like, you wrote that movie and then you follow up with this one and it's great, but you have Katherine Heigl who was just coming off of Knocked Up, which was so funny. Mm-hmm. She was so funny in it. And then she goes to 27 Dresses and she gets to play this like dowdy, kind of sad, passive lead character. Yeah. And I'm saying this knowing that I love Jane as a character because I think she's very relatable to me as a person, because I wouldn't be the Malin Ackerman like terror.
And I think that's what makes it, I think that what makes but it approachable. It's also,
she's very passive though and very sad, and it's just not as funny. Like, it's rom-com, but like definitely not as much calm.
I think you could have had more fun with her sadness. She's definitely sad, but it's not fun.
Yeah, she should be have like a cat.
I want to see her like pouring coffee on herself.
That's sort of her arc, though. I mean, she's this dowdy sister that struggles with this stuff, and then she sort of comes into her own. She gets drunk with James Marsden. She kind of lets down her hair. She's always been the reliable sister, and I think that like as a viewer, they want you to relate to like sort of being that reliable person, that supportive person that has to deal with your friends' hijinks. And then she comes into her own. He kind of helps her open up, and they get drunk, and they dance, and they sing, and she sort of gets sassier. And then fights back with her sister, and I think she stands up for herself. And like, it is a little vicious, but it's comedy. And I think that like, for me, it was sort of like her arc of finding herself. And I think that she kind of gets these kind of funny moments. And at the end, when she's trying to get to him and she's running and she jumps over onto the ship and then she trips and falls, and she's got these kind of like physical humor moments.
Yeah.
And so I think it has that there. I think that she as a character starts off as a more passive, weaker character, but throughout the film, she finds her voice.
Yeah.
I just wanted more of those moments, because the Benny and the Jets scene in the bar is great. Anytime Judy Greer's in the movie is great, but she's in very little.
Yeah, she really
I was surprised when I was watching it again, because I was like, oh, wow, she isn't in this much.
I think she's just very memorable in the movie.
She's memorable in everything.
So, but I do agree that I wish her sad was more funny sad, because that's one thing I like about The Wedding Singer, not to bring up my movie again, but is when Robbie gets really sad, his sad is probably funnier than the rest of the movie.
It's the funniest part of the movie.
Yeah, like him, like the depressed Robbie Hart is.
And like singing Love Sings at the wedding.
Like, yeah. And again, and my movie, I think, also has the best one use of the F-bomb in the song.
It's pretty choice.
Where he's his hate song towards his ex-fiance, Linda. It's just amazing.
Linda, you're a bitch.
You're a bitch. Yeah.
Okay, so can we all dump on Blast from the Past now?
Yes. No time. We're out of time. We got to move on. I'll tell you why it's amazing before we dump on.
Okay.
This movie is wonderful because it, again, weaves familiar tropes but puts a new spin on it. one thing that we see, and it's a part of our rubric, is does your rom-com involve magic? Does it include magic? We have a great example of like Kate and Leopold. Hugh Jackman is transported to modern times, and he's this old-timey guy.
And like Liev Schreiber is in it as like this like nerdy neighbor, and it's so not him.
Oh, her ex-boyfriend.
Yeah. Well, he's a neighbor. He lives downstairs.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have these movies that incorporate elements of magic to get this kind of fish out of water story. And one thing I really like about Blast from the Past is it is weaving a fish out of water story in that Brendan Fraser is completely unfamiliar with the world. He's never experienced any, he's never met anyone other than his parents, which is crazy. So you have this fish out of water story. Then you also kind of have this time travel story in that he is very much a product of 1960s America. And is raising that and has no idea that the world has moved on. So you get these kind of tropes, but it's all kind of grounded in reality. It's in a weird reality, but it's something that could happen.
Very original.
Yeah. So that's one thing I was like, that's kind of cool.
I think my hypothesis is that they just saw every character that Brendan Fraser has ever played and said, let's do another one of those. George of the Jungle, Encino Man.
Yep.
Let's do another character where Brendan Fraser doesn't know how to act with the rest of society.
Big eyed naivete in everything.
So I think they just saw him a bunch and was like, what movie could we do using that? Let's do it again.
Like the Brendan Fraser era.
It was an era, a great era. And he does it superbly well. But there are movies where I think he shows a bit more of a range than this one where Bedazzled. He plays the same.
That he does.
It's true. Bedazzled is a great movie.
It's a movie.
One of my issues with Blast from the Past is that...
Bring it.
I don't get how Alicia Silverstone likes him. I mean, I understand how endearing he is, but... He's kind of an imbecile. Like he's charming and he's sweet and he's nice, but he's so naive. And as like a real like 20 something woman who is like, you know, a streetwise girl, like I don't get like how I wanted him to be a little more grounded and a little less absurd. And if he had been more of a like a real man and not just kind of this goofy caricature, I would have bought it so much more. But her falling for him, I'm just like, I don't see it. He's too silly.
To be fair, he is very silly. He is very naive and kind of this ridiculous character. And for a long time, he is very grating to Alicia Silverstone. She does not like his whole thing. And she doesn't believe, she doesn't know that he's from the past. She's like, this dude's like on the Asperger's spectrum for sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which he probably is. So we address that in the film. Dave Foley, Troy, who's Alicia Silverstone's best friend, gives Brendan Fraser the advice saying like, look, you know, you're a real nice boy, but she needs a nice man. And he kind of grows up in the film. He learns how to kind of grow up and be a little more chill.
It
and
is
how
the
to,
last
how to adult.
Half hour or so.
But that shift felt like instantaneous to me. And I wanted maybe after that speech, more of like a montage or something of him kind of like finding his manhood or finding himself as a man. And I felt like all of a sudden he was like, oh yeah, I'm a man. And he like his voice got deeper and he was like more serious and gazing into her
and
eyes.
And the thing with the knee. The and
knee thing.
Low.
And yeah. I mean like super sexy. I was really into it. But I just didn't buy that transition so quickly. I was
it
like,
happens fast.
It was very abrupt.
It does happen fast. My theory is that maybe, you know, there's a scene where he's out there in the rain and she brings him in and maybe he was changing and she saw his penis and it's just like, well, got to date that.
It's true.
I don't know. That might be a deleted scene. I'm just saying
he find his man,
I
mean,
it happens quick, but they do address the fact that he needs to grow up. He needs to be more of an adult. And that's when the shift happens for her. It's not, I love this goofy guy, you know, or he is a goofy guy that she does love, but they address that in the film.
I think that you could put like say insert person here as Eve and he would have literally fallen in love with the first woman he saw.
That's
he has
true.
Never seen a human adult woman before.
That's not his mother.
Eve could have been any woman and in the story it would have just been the same thing. Like that's the thing that I was like, I wish they had had a scene or something before where he could have rejected somebody or said like, oh, this isn't what I'm looking for. Instead of first woman, bring her to cave now.
Yeah. I do believe that in a way this film is a spiritual sequel to Encino Man. So I think that checks out. It is also a spiritual sequel to Clueless. This is what happens to Cher after she finally grows up and leaves. She would definitely be, talk about ridiculous jobs.
But she would never live in the Valley.
Right. Alicia Silverstone sort of like is in the sports memorabilia business.
Yeah.
Again, you talk about ridiculous.
Like, how did that happen? How did she get that? How does she know the price of all of these cards?
Right.
Like the dude who owns that shop, I believe has that job. You know, like
Mazel fucking Tov is another good use of the one.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm like, she does not, like, where, how did she get that job?
My movie was not PG-13, so there were no F-bombs, but it was the best PG movie of 1993.
There you go. I'll give you that one.
I think my other, like, really petty complaint about the movie was that all I could think watching it when he left was like, oh my god, you haven't been exposed to any germs. Like, you're going to get sick with the first person you encounter. That's, I was like, you've been living in a bubble for 35 years. Like, this guy is definitely going to get really sick really quickly.
Especially, like, where the place that their elevator goes to, like, is the most dirty, run-down bar.
Oh, it's so gross.
There's syphilis on every stool, on every counter in that place. You see the dude running that joint?
Like, he's definitely going to get, like, a really bad case of the flu and be one of those, like, cases that dies because he has no immune system.
For sure.
Quarantine him and shit. Yeah.
Can I make this argument for the film before we kind of start to wrap this up? I will say that it's impressive that Blast from the Past works because you have a very, as we've talked about, ridiculous character in Brendan Fraser, but Brendan Fraser pulls it off. It kind of reminds me of Tom Hanks in Big. Like, you've ever watched Big? I fully believe that Tom Hanks is a child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And he does it very subtly. And Brendan Fraser kind of has this charm. He makes this character somehow likable. You root for him. And he has this kind of innocence. And he's kind of boyish because he doesn't know anything. And his immune system's trying to kill him all the time, probably.
Always.
But the fact that they managed to pull off the premise with really great casting. And like Christopher Walken and Sissy Spacek are amazing as his parents.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's an
achievement. I think that's the strength of the Brendan Fraser era, is that he always played those kind of goofy,
with the exception of The Mummy, which is interesting because he's so good in The Mummy. And that's like his first time kind of not playing the weird, quirky dude.
Well, he was like the sexy leading man in that. And he had comedy moments, but like...
But he's not like the Encino Man this or Bedazzled or whatever. He's always kind of these weird, quirky character dudes.
And The Mummy was like the only real like big kind of movie that he was like the leading man so for. And he's perfect. And
he's super believable as
man,
like,
of my dreams.
Leading action man, like Brendan Fraser gets with Rachel Weisz in that movie,
but you believe it. But you believe it. You're like, yeah, they would.
Yeah,
because in real life, I think like any woman would have gotten together with Brendan Fraser in that movie.
Fuck this Royal Rumble. Let's just talk about the. Let's just talk about The Mummy.
I think that should be the next podcast. Just all The Mummy.
The Mummy, so much.
But I think, going off of what you said, I think it is a real strength of all of our films is the charm of the actors and actresses. Yes. I think rom-coms are very much dependent on their leads. Mm-hmm. And I think we all chose really well in finding movies that had really charming leads in both male and female roles.
And the chemistry is important. Yes. And I think that all of these movies have good chemistry.
Yeah, I think it's... Sorry, I'm going to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I think it's the charm of the two leading the actors and actresses, the chemistry, and then I think what's also very, very rom-com-y is the kind of like quirky, wacky best friends or something like that. And I think all of our movies have really, really good, like the Judy Greers, you know, or the Rosie O'Donnells, or the Dave Foley's. Dave Foley?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was going to say something. Matt Foley is living in a van. Yeah. And so, but then mine is like, you have Sammy and Holly, who are both so, so good. I think those are the three things. It's like, if the charm, the chemistry, and then the good supporting cast. And it's just, in all of ours, I think, again, as much as we rag on each other, these are all such great movies.
Yes.
And I mean, I think that's proof because these movies aren't recent and we all chose movies that are older and we all chose movies that haven't been out in at least like 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
And people still watch these movies. People still like these movies and they're still kind of timeless. And there's so many romantic comedies that have come out that have totally been lost in time.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Right.
I mean, there's so many that, remember that like Vegas one with Ashton Kutcher? Like, who watches that?
No.
There's so many ones that no one watches anymore. And these ones I think are still kind of those pinnacles.
Yeah, more often than not, they kind of die after time.
Nora Ephron she purposefully did that with this movie, where the music, unlike everyone else's, is not pop music. Yeah. It's standards and classics. All this, Celine Dion sang the last song, so I counted it for points because it's Celine Dion.
She's also a queen, so.
Yeah. So, but she wanted, and all the wardrobe was very purposefully classic silhouettes, like 1940s looks, because she didn't want it to be a movie that you'd watch 20 years from now and say, oh, that was so 90s.
And it definitely works, because that movie is really timeless. Like, and you watch that movie, yeah, and it's
so that was a very purposeful decision. But I think at this point we've all ragged on each other, so I think we need to each make like a really quick 1 minute last minute stand for our films before we go to our pop quiz that we always do.
All right, I'll begin, you guys. I do implore people to watch Blast from the Past because it's so fun. It's using great, charming people to really weave together a story as a whole. Like, this movie really relies on each of its characters equally, and they build a really fun, funny story where you're really rooting for Adam, Brendan Fraser's character, and also for Alicia Silverstone and Eve, and they're Adam and Eve. I mean, come on. But this, again, finds a new twist, a new fun way to bring you a fish out of water story, and essentially a time travel story with someone who's kind of lost in time, or stuck in time, rather. So it's just super fun, super charming, familiar, and yet new at the same time. So Blast from the Past, you guys. It's a blast in any time period you watch it.
Okay, I'll talk with The Wedding Singer real quick and give my last little pitch. This movie, if you haven't seen The Wedding Singer, and I feel like a lot of people have, if you haven't, please, please watch it. Just for, I mean, again, talking about Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, about one of the most iconic rom-com couples of all time, which is Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. Just so good. Everyone's so charming. The music is great. It's just hella 80s, but it works because, again, it's just such a just ridiculously 80s movie. Adam Sandler, you really get to see what his potential is and like what he can do, and like, and really just see him thrive in a movie that I think is really, really good. But one thing that no one ragged on my movie for was like the comedy. There's no one saying like, oh, it could be funnier. Da, da, da. My movie is also hysterical. It is so funny, and it's just really ridiculous. And it's just, if you're looking for a good time, watch The Wedding Singer.
Okay.
So 27 Dresses, I feel like, is like the sort of the pinnacle of like romantic comedies of the 2000s. I mean, you've got this great story of this girl and this guy who don't like each other. They have good chemistry. I mean, like, it's romantic. Who wouldn't want to have like a sexy banter with James Marsden? They hook up in a car. Like, it's kind of everything and it's raining. So it's kind of everything you've ever dreamed of. I feel like it's such a feel good movie. It's sweet. Ed Burns is wonderful. And he's not like the cliched mean guy, like, or the mean boyfriend. Like, he's a good guy. He's a decent guy. And I think that like, it's a good story. It's, you feel good about it. You watch it and you're like, oh, I love that. And I want that. And I want to have my own romantic Katherine Heigl adventure. And I just think it's like a perfect, you know, fun romantic comedy.
Nice.
Beautiful. Okay, and we'll wrap it up. I'm not even going to assume that nobody has seen this movie or has missed out on it, because everyone has.
If you've seen Philadelphia, not the same movie.
If you haven't watched it recently, go check out the Oscar-nominated screenplay written Sleepless in Seattle. It's just got a cast that could go on for ages. Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, Vincent Garber, Rosie O'Donnell, Bill Pullman, Rob Reiner. It's incredible.
Hell of a cast.
It's very funny. It's a very funny movie, but it's very romantic, and it doesn't have any meanness. There's no mean streak in this movie. No mean character. It is a movie about adult people living their lives, about it's possible to find love again even after heartbreak, and about daring to follow your instincts that will lead you in the right direction. So it's just a truly romantic movie starring the greatest rom-com couple of all time, Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. And it's just, and Nora Ephron directed it. And as if you're a feminist, I think it's a very interesting choice that my movie is the one that doesn't end in wedding bells for the leads, or it doesn't have to do with marriage. It's about two adult people that are trying to find out if they like each other.
Fair enough. And with that, we will wrap up the argument portion. Folks,
oh man,
we want to hear from you.
I love them all, guys. I love all your movies.
Heated and debate.
Yes, it's heated. True. I'm sorry.
We really love all of our movies.
They're great
movies.
That's
why we're arguing them, and I hate to tear it down, but you know, it's fun. It's fun sometimes to find flaws, even in the things you love. Is there a problem with anything, or is it really bulletproof like Blast from the Past? So,
but speaking of finding problems with things you love, and maybe there's no problems with the things you love, like our podcast, and you want to give us a rating to let us know that. Mm-hmm. Please, please, please let us know how much you love our show, The Flawless Brothers Murph Get Smart, on iTunes by giving us a rating on any podcast app you use. 5 stars would be great, or 4, I guess, but let's go 5.
Fine.
That's the way other people will find the show. Please tell people you know about the show. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from you all, but if you want to tell us in iTunes review form or on any of our social medias at The Brothers Murph on any social media forum, we'd love to talk to all of you about all this, especially because you're the ones who are going to be deciding who is the ultimate winner of this battle royale. We are all passionate about all of these movies. We can't choose. Mm-hmm. You guys are going to have to.
Absolutely. So please do let us know on social media which of these movies you think we argued the best. And also let us know what your favorite rom-com is, so that we may argue it in the future, or check it out if for some reason we haven't seen it, which I'm sure there's some great film that we haven't ever seen that we are just waiting to see. Like Tremors is a great rom-com. Kramer versus Kramer.
As much as like Nick last week wanted to interact with people about board games, if there are rom-coms you can recommend to me, please tell me, because I like watch them every other day. So
that's like Casey and I's favorite pastime. Yes, is like watching romantic movies.
Absolutely.
That's how we became friends. We have a list of like romantic movies that we watch, and that's how we became friends.
Give us more to add, please.
Yes.
Please. So thank you so much for that, guys. Now we're going to do a special edition of the pop quiz, because we got to have a pop quiz, y'all. We're all about that trivia. But we have 4 kind of equal hosts here, so we're going to do a round robin edition where each of us ask one question that's related to our movie in some way, and we see if we can get some stuff. So without further ado, it is time for the
quiz. Pop quiz. It's time for the pop quiz. Quiz. Pop quiz. We'll laugh when Nick loses.
Pop quiz.
All right, y'all, I think it's time. Who wants to begin with the pop quiz here?
I do.
Go for it.
Because my question's not good.
Let's get it out of the way.
Because I was looking up like trivia on The Wedding Singer, and there was just literally nothing interesting. There's nothing like, there's no funny thing or like, oh, Sean Connery was really supposed to play Bobby Hart. Nothing weird. Like, it was just, very. And so I started looking up like trivia about the different actors and actresses, and there's still not anything weird. So we're going to go with Drew Barrymore is allergic to 4 things.
Okay.
Okay.
What are those 4 things? You can each guess 2, we'll say. So we'll have more.
Okay. Strawberries.
Okay.
Oh, that was my guess.
What's your second guess?
What's your second one?
Oh, cheese.
Just cheese. Cheese.
Not dairy, but cheese specifically.
Specifically Gouda.
There you go.
I'm going to say gluten. Maybe she's got a gluten allergy, and I don't know. She's on the Santa Clarita diet now, so what do I know? let's say, what are other people? Pineapple.
Okay. I'm going to say coconut and dog spit.
All right. All right.
We got some of those right.
No, you sure didn't. Oh, man. We have garlic.
What?
That's so sad. Garlic is my favorite food group.
Coffee. Yeah.
Coffee? What?
Perfume?
I don't know
what that means. Perfume. So she's pretty.
Some people have like sensitivities.
Like sensitive to smell. Like
yeah. And bees.
Oh yeah, right. Bees, okay, make sense. Bees. One of us should have guessed.
I was thinking food things.
Yeah,
that's where my brain is at. Is food? It's always at food.
Yeah, that was really. There's not much more interesting.
So I think I got the
there's
point.
There's something else
closest,
like,
with something related to an animal. Yeah. So bam.
That's it. Point.
I'll go.
Okay.
So in Blast from the Past, Adam has a collection of very old baseball cards. He has a bunch of stuff from the 60s. Everything was put down in the shelter, including Christopher Walken had been collecting baseball cards. So when Brendan Fraser first meets Alicia Silverstone, he's in a place that sells and buys baseball cards. So he has this box. He has no idea that these things are worth a lot of money. And the creepy pawn shop owner dude is looking at the box and sees all these things and tries to get Brendan Fraser to sell the box for $500, the entire box. He brings up a rookie Mickey Mantle card specifically, and he says, I'll buy the whole box for $500. In 2015, a rookie Mickey Mantle card sold to in an auction to some anonymous person How much do you think that card sold for?
What was it in the movie?
It was like 4,000 or 2,000.
They don't go into Mickey Mantle specifically. Oh. They go into other players' cards.
Oh, okay. Lord.
One of them is valued at 4,000. In the movie.
I have no reference.
I'm going to go $8,000.
Okay.
I'm going to go $47,000.
I'm going to go freaking 100 grand.
It's a baseball card.
Even 100K.
100 grand. So Casey is the closest.
No!
In 2015, a Mickey Mantle rookie card sold for $525,000.
What?
Oh,
what?
My God.
Holy cow. Because he's a like great baseball stuff. Player of all time.
No, I
Shut
know
your
that,
mouth.
But like, it's...
So I have a really...
I didn't know baseball cards were still that big.
So yeah.
Okay, what's your question, Michelle?
Okay, so my question is, James Marsden's character, Kevin, is really kind of cynical and bitter about love.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, why is he so cynical and angry?
Oh God, I don't remember.
It's a plot point.
It is a plot point.
Yeah, his wife... cheated on him. No,
that'd be ridiculous.
What is it?
I'm gonna say that she left him because he was just too darn pretty.
No, I think
she couldn't compete.
I think she cheated on him with somebody he knew.
She has a club foot. He's not cool with that.
Yeah. She left him for another man.
Yeah. He was again. Cuckolded.
All right. Not getting back into it, but come on.
No way.
Why would anyone leave James Marsden?
Maybe that movie takes place in purgatory. Like he's like left for some lady by some dude who probably was like balding, and then like he has to write for weddings.
He has to live with the knowledge that he wasn't good enough.
That's so crazy, man.
All right, Kesai.
Okay, so we know that there's actually a very good child actor in Sleepless in Seattle. The son is adorable, but he wasn't the first choice to play that child actor. It was actually someone we all know now, today, who is now an adult person. So who was the first choice to play... Tom Hanks' son in the movie.
Oh my God, I don't know child actors from the...
It's 93. I have a couple
now.
Ideas.
Famous now.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Elijah Wood.
Damn you, son of a bitch. Well, then I'm going to go Macaulay Culkin.
I was going to say him.
Okay, you'll say... No.
Who was going to play Jonah, you guys?
Okay, you say Macaulay Culkin.
No, you said it.
Nah, you say you didn't know anybody else, so let him...
Okay, I'll take Macaulay Culkin.
Well, damn, I don't know now. Devin Sawa.
I said he was famous now, guys.
I know.
Jason Schwartzman.
Really?
Yeah, Jason Schwartzman.
Elijah Wood's famous now.
No, I know, but...
What are you talking about?
Really bitter about that.
You can't be like... I'm talking about someone
Lord
known
of the Rings
like
will
Jason
always
Schwartzman.
Be famous.
No, but... Yeah, okay, well, whatever. It's Jason Schwartzman. Very interesting.
Jason Schwartzman, lead of the hit franchise I Heart Huckabees 1, 2, and 3.
Also, a side character actor. In Mozart in the Jungle, which is excellent.
That's awesome. There
you should watch that show.
Wait, can I do one more real bonus? Because really funny.
Yes.
Okay. So there was a scene that was completely improvised in the film. Can you guess which scene it was in Sleepless in Seattle?
I'm guessing Rob Reiner and Tom Hanks talking about butts.
Okay.
I would guess like Bill Pullman at meeting the parents and like sneezing and all that jazz.
Okay.
The butt one was going to be mine, so I'm going to second that one.
It was actually the scene where they were talking about the Dirty Dozen after Rita Wilson started crying over An Affair to Remember. They improvised
awesome.
The whole scene where they started crying over that movie.
That is so a impressive. Truly funny moment in a mostly not funny
part. Oh, my God.
He's holding to that not funny part.
I thought that really scene was funny.
Great. That scene was great. Well, there you have it, you guys. Those are our arguments on these four films. Again, we love them all. I think you should watch them all if you haven't. They are all wonderful. They're still in our lives for a reason, folks. So do check out those films and let us know what you think. And I guess for now, I have been Michael Lee Murphy.
I'm Nick Murphy.
Casey Brown.
And I'm Michelle Fortier.
And we are imploring you all to stay loving.
Gross.
Why?
And thank you, Michelle.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. This has been amazing.
Yeah, thank you for being on. So fun.
I'm just going to be fading this out, so we're getting quieter and quieter, and people are going to be listening harder.
We're having, like, really serious conversations right. about
my social security number is 4297.